of Turnus, brave Numa, and the ginger-haired Camertes, whose father was generous Volscens, the biggest of all Italian landowners, and governed Amicli, where no one might sound the alarm. Even as Aegeon, whom legend relates to have had 100 arms and hands, to have breathed out fire from 50 mouths and 50 chests, to have fought against Jupiter's thunderbolts with 50 identical shields clanging and 50 swords, just so did Aeneas, once he had wetted his steel with blood, storm over the battlefield irresistibly. Look how he goes at Niphaeus' four-horse chariot, head-on at him and his horses. They, when they see his giant strides and hear him bellowing hideous threats, wheel round in panic and bolt away towards the shore with the chariot, tipping their master out of it. Meantime, Lucagus charges into the fray on his chariot, drawn by two white horses, his brother Liger beside him as driver, and he himself whirling his sword with furious purpose. Aeneas could not abide the way they came charging at full pelt. Made for them, stood in their path, a giant, his spear at the ready. Liger cried, "These aren't the horses of Diomed or Achilles' chariot before you. You aren't on the plains of Troy. No, this very spot is now going to see the end of the war, and of you." They were flung to the winds, those crazy words of Liger. The Trojan hero's reply was not to reply in words, but to hurl his spear at the enemy. Lucagus, leaning right forward and lashing the horses on with the flat of his sword, now took up position for combat. His left foot advanced. As he did so, Aeneas' spear passed through the rim of his shining shield at the bottom, then penetrated his left groin. He was knocked out of the chariot and rolled on the ground, dying. Aeneas the True addressed these bitter words to his victim. "Lucagus, you're not betrayed by your chariot horses running too slowly, or shying away from some bodiless enemy shadow. It's you who abandoned them, jumping down from the wheels." So saying, he gripped the horses' bridles. Poor Liger slid down from the chariot, and quite unnerved held out imploring hands to Aeneas. "Sir Trojan, have pity, I beg you, and spare my life. I entreat you, by your own soul, by the parents who gave the world such a great man." He'd have gone on beseeching, but Aeneas broke in, "Your language was different just now. You're to die. Brothers should stick together." Then he broached the heart of Liger, the crypt of life, with his blade. Such were the killings done all over the field by the Dardan leader, who stormed like a river in spate or a black cyclone. Finally, Prince Ascanius and the Trojan garrison made a successful sortie from their encampment. The siege was lifted. Meanwhile, uninvited, Jupiter spoke to Juno. "Sister and most beloved consort of mine, it's Venus, just as you thought. You are not mistaken in so thinking, who buoys up the Trojan cause. It is not their own resilient strength, their warlike temper and steadiness under fire." Juno meekly replied, "My fairest husband, why do you tease me? I am sick-hearted and overawed by your stern words. If my love had the influence on you that once it had, and still should have, you would surely not refuse this to Juno, you, the all-powerful, that I might at least convey my Turnus out of the battle and keep him unscathed for Daunus, his father? As it is, let him die and atone with his patriot blood to the Trojans. Although he can trace his origin back to the gods, for Pilumnus was his grandfather's grandsire, although he has often loaded your altars with a wealth of offerings, a lavish hand." To her, the Lord of Olympus on high made this brief answer. If it's a short reprieve from death, a mere breathing space for one who is doomed, that you ask, if you realize fully my meaning, you may snatch Turnus away to escape his impending fate for a little. So far I may indulge you. But if your petition conceals some further demand on my goodwill, if you imagine the war's result is being changed or affected, your hopes are vain." And Juno replied in tears, "What if your will should grant what your words grudge, and long life be assured after all for Turnus? As it is, though he's done no wrong, a hard end awaits him, or else I am wide of the mark. Would rather I were deluded by empty fears, and you, as you can, might think again, alter your policy." When she had spoken, Juno at once came down from the heights of heaven, cloud enshrouded, riding upon the storm, and made for the Trojan lines and Laurentine camp. Out of thin mist she supernaturally fashioned a strengthless and insubstantial wraith to look like Aeneas, a miracle apparition. Hung it with Trojan weapons, faking the shield and the plumed helmet the hero wore, endowed it with lifelike tongue, an automaton's speech, and made it mimic the gait of Aeneas. It resembled the phantom figures that flit, they say, after death, or the dream images that seem real when we are sleeping. Well, that figure gleefully stalked out in front of the fighters, provoking the foe with its weapons, uttering loud taunts. Turnus went for it, hurled from a distance a whirring spear at the phantom, which, wheeling about, retreated from him. Then Turnus really believed that Aeneas had shirked a fight and was running. Bemused by this, he began to nourish unjustified hopes. "Aeneas, where are you off to? Don't welsh on your marriage contract. I'll give you the land you have crossed the seas to find, 6 feet of it." Turnus, shouting these words and brandishing his sword, pursued, not knowing that what so thrilled him was only a doppelganger. Now it happened a ship was lying, moored to the lofty side of a rocky mole, with its gangway and rope ladders all in position, the ship which had brought King Osinius here from the shores of Clusium. This way the apparition of fleeing Aeneas hastened and plunged into hiding. Turnus, following swift on its heels, surmounted all obstacles and bounded across the high gangway. The instant he was aboard, Juno cut the cables and whisked out the unmoored vessel upon a receding wave. But Aeneas kept challenging the man who had vanished to fight him. Many the foes he slew as he scoured the field after Turnus. Then did his double, that tissue of air, try to hide no longer, but soaring aloft was soon absorbed into the dark clouds. Turnus, far out at sea now, was driven on by the gale. He had no idea of the truth, no gratitude for his deliverance, kept looking back, stretched out both hands to heaven in prayer. "Father Almighty, do I deserve to incur so grave a reproach, to be punished so sorely? Was this your will and your judgment? Where and from what am I being taken? I cannot fathom this running away, its means or its end. How can I face Laurentum again, my town and stronghold? What of the men who followed my flag, all left to die? Such a death, I can't speak of it. I'm so ashamed. All scattered now. I can see them and hear their groans as they fall. What am I to do? What grave would be deep enough now to hide my dishonour? Oh, rather, you winds, take pity and dash this vessel on rock or reef from my heart, I implore you. Pile it up on some merciless quicksand, anywhere beyond the ken of my people, the reach of my shameful story." So Turnus spoke, and his mind was all one surge and backwash, whether to fling himself on his sword in desperation at such a disgrace, and drive the cruel blade through his ribs, or throw himself into the deep sea, and try to swim back to the shore of the bay, so he might once more wade in at the Trojan soldiers. 3 times he began to attempt either alternative. 3 times great Juno held him back, and, pitying him, prevented it. Onwards he went through the deep, with wave and current behind him, until he brought up at the ancient town of his father, Daunus. Meanwhile, prompted by Jupiter, Mezentius dashingly took Turnus' place in the fight and attacked the exultant Teucrians. The Etruscans closed in upon him. With all their hatred, with all their firepower, they concentrated on him alone. He, like some rocky cliff that juts out into the wild sea, exposed to the tempest's fury and the full force of the waves, outstaying the threats, the concerted violence of sea and sky, standing immovable there, so Mezentius stood, and laid low Hebrus, son of Dolichaeon, Lategus, fleet-footed Palmus. Lategus he got with a stone, a regular chunk of mountain, full in the mouth and face, while Palmus he hamstrung and left to wallow disabled, giving his armour to Lausus to wear on his own person and stick the plumes on his helmet. He killed Evanthes, too, a Phrygian, and Mimas, the friend and coeval of Paris, born to his mother Theano, and his father Amycus, on the same night that Hecuba, pregnant with fire, gave birth to Paris. Paris, he sleeps in his native soil, but Mimas is buried, a stranger, in Italy. Now, like a boar which the hounds have driven down from the mountains, snapping at his heels, a boar that has sheltered for years on pine-crowned Vesulus, or one that has skulked in the Laurentine fenland, feeding upon the reed-beds, but now it is in the toils of the hunters, at bay, ferociously snorting, its shoulders bristling, and none of them has the nerve to get his blood up and go closer, but from a safe distance they assail it with yells and missiles. Just so, of all who cherished a righteous wrath at Mezentius, not a single one had the courage to draw his sword and close with him. No, they stood off, shouting, hurling weapons, baiting him. But he, undaunted, unflurried, turned all ways to confront them, setting his teeth, while the spears bounced off his back like raindrops. From the ancient township of Corythus had come a man of Greek origin, Acron, a refugee, who had left his betrothed there, unwed still. Mezentius spotted him far off in the thick of the battle, wearing his lady's favours, a purple garment and plumes of crimson. Then, like a famishing lion which pads to and fro through the jungle, as often happens, compelled by crazed hunger, and when he has marked down some timorous goat, it may be, or a stag with its antlers pricked up, exults, huge jaws agape, hair standing on end, and crouches over the kill, claws deep in the flesh, his ravenous muzzle horribly steeped with gore. Just so did Mezentius eagerly spring right into the thick of the foe, and felled poor Acron, who, dying, drummed with his heels on the darkening ground, and stained with his blood the broken spear. Mezentius, now, would not cheapen himself by killing Orodes, who was running away, with a spear cast, a wound in the back. Instead, he ran to cut off and meet him, face to face, confronted him, mastered him, not by underhand means, but hand to hand. Then he planted his foot on the fallen, strained at his spear, and cried, "Comrades, here lies Orodes, one of our tallest obstacles." His friends took up the cry of triumph with one great shout. But the dying Orodes said, "My death will be avenged. You have not long to rejoice in your triumph, whoever you are. For a like fate awaits you. The same earth shall cover you later. Now Mezentius, smiling but angry too, replied, Die then! Leave my future to the Father of Gods and King of Mortals! With these words he plucked his spear from the body. Unkind repose, the iron sleep weighed down Orodes' eyes. His eyelids closed for everlasting night. Caedicus slew Alcathous, Sacrator slew Hydaspes, Rapo slew Parthenius and the very powerful Orses, Messapus slew Clonius and Erichetes, the son of Lycaon. The one while he lay on the ground, his bridleless steed having stumbled, the other in combat on foot. Aegis, the Lycian, had ridden forward, but Valerus, skilled in the fighting mode of his fathers, unhorsed him. Thronius fell to Salius, he to Nealces, famed both for javelin work and the arrow that kills at a distance. Now the hard hand of the war god was dealing out impartially death and agony. Either side had its ups and downs, its killings and fallen alike, but neither dreamed of retreating. In the halls of Jove, the gods felt pity for all that pointless fury. To think that men should inflict such pains on their fellows. Saturnian Juno and Venus sat well apart, looking down where pale Tisiphone raged among the embattled armies. But now Mezentius, shaking his mighty spear, strode forth over the field like some tornado. As great Orion moves forward, cleaving his way, with his feet treading the floor of the deepest mid-ocean, his shoulders overtopping the waves, or, when he's carrying back from the hills some venerable ash tree, walking upon the ground he buries his head in the cloud base, so, with his giant weapons, Mezentius advanced. On the other side, Aeneas, seeing him there in the long column, went out to meet him. Mezentius, undismayed, awaited his heroic foe, stood firm and massive. Then, judging by eye the moment Aeneas would come within spear range, May this right hand, which is God to me, and this spear I am poising, bring me luck now. Lausus, I'll clothe you in armor stripped from this brigand's corpse. You shall be a living trophy, I vow, of my victory over Aeneas. He spoke. At long range his spear went whistling, but ricocheted from the shield of Aeneas to pierce good Antores, who stood nearby, between his thigh and his ribs. Antores, a friend of Hercules, who had come on a mission from Argos, attached himself to Evander and settled in a town of Italy. Felled by a weapon meant for another, he now gazed up at the sky, and his last moments were filled with thoughts of dear Argos. Aeneas the True then hurled his spear, which went through the convex, triple bronze face of the shield, its layers of linen, its innermost backing composed of threefold bull's hide, and lodged low down in Mezentius' groin. But it failed to drive home deep. So Aeneas, elated to see his enemy bleeding, promptly drew his sword from its scabbard and went for the dazed man with furious energy. Lausus, seeing this happen, groaned deeply in sympathy for his beloved father, and tears rolled down his cheeks. How could I pass over in silence the heroic action of Lausus, and the hard death befell him? He's worthy of fame, and we may credit such deeds because long tradition allows us to do so. Mezentius was giving ground, crippled and sorely encumbered, with his enemy's spear stuck fast in his shield, dragging behind him, when Lausus, his son, leaped forward and intervened in the combat. Just as Aeneas was rising on tiptoe to slash Mezentius, Lausus thrust out his own sword, parried the blow, and held him in check. His comrades hailed the action with a loud shout. And while the father drew back under cover of Lausus' shield, they tried to beat off Aeneas with volleys of missiles fired from a distance. Aeneas, baffled and angry, kept his guard up. It was like when the storm clouds burst, scattering down their shrapnel of hailstones. All the ploughmen and labourers have dispersed hurriedly from the fields, and the traveller is sheltering somewhere in safety, beneath a riverbank maybe, or a cornice of rock, while the downpour drenches the earth. And they wait for the sun to come back and let them get on with their work. Aeneas, snowed under with missiles from every angle, endured the blizzard of war and waited for it to be spent, taunting and threatening Lausus the while. "Why rush upon death like this? You're too rash, fighting out of your class, and your loyalty's tempting you to your ruin." But Lausus continued his crazy defiance, and now the Trojan commander's rage boiled up more deeply. Now the fate spinners passed through their fingers the last threads of Lausus' life. Yes, Aeneas drove his strong sword right through the young man's body and buried it there to the hilt. It penetrated his light shield, frail armour for so aggressive a lad, and the tunic his mother had woven of pliant gold, and soaked it with blood from his breast. Then the soul left the body, passing sadly away through the air to the land of shadows. But when Aeneas beheld the dying boy's look, his face, a face that by now was strangely grey, he felt pity for him, and a deep sigh escaped him. He stretched out his hand to Lausus, who had conjured up for his mind's eye a picture of filial devotion. "Poor lad, what now can I give you, to show how I honour your brave deed, or worthy of such a fine character? What can Aeneas do? These arms you were so proud of, keep them. Also, for what it is worth, I give you back to the ashes and shades of your fathers. At least it shall soften the edge of your piteous death for you, that the great Aeneas caused it." What's more, he rebuked the hesitant comrades of Lausus, and lifted the body, its neatly ordered hair befouled with blood, and gave it into their hands. Meantime, beside the stream of Tiber, the father of Lausus was cleansing his wound with water, as he reclined with his back propped up against a tree trunk. His bronze helmet is hung on a branch nearby, and his heavy accoutrements rest on the grass. Round him the bodyguard stands. Mezentius, sick and gasping, eases his neck, and the beard flows down to cover his chest. He keeps on asking about his son, keeps sending messengers, bearing commands from an anxious sire to recall him from battle. But Lausus' friends were bearing his lifeless body in tears on his shield, a heroic lad laid low by a wound from a hero. Mezentius, who had a premonition of evil, sensed their grief from afar. He sullied his grey hair with dust, extended to heaven his clasped hands, and clung to his son's body. "My son! Was I so eager to go on living that I allowed you to take my place, to take the enemy's sword? You, my own son! Oh, that I should have been saved by these wounds! Alive because you are dead! Ah, God, the bitterness of death comes home to me now at last. The wound goes deep. For I have tarnished your name with my own disrepute as well, since I was driven from the throne of my fathers in execration. Long had I owed my country, my people who loathed me, atonement. I was the guilty one. Would I had died a thousand deaths. Instead, I live on, mankind and the light of day still unrelinquished. But leave them I will." So saying, he struggles up onto his wounded thigh, and although the deep wound drains his strength and hampers him, will not give in, but orders his horse to be brought. His treasure and comfort this animal was. He had ridden it out of every battle, victorious. Now he addressed the sorrowing beast.
"Rebus, we have lived long. If anything can be called long in human affairs, today you shall bear back triumphantly Aeneas' head and his blood-stained armour, sharing with me revenge for the pangs of Lausus. Or else, if that end is beyond our strength, we shall fall together. Brave steed, you would never consent, I know it, to have a new master, a Trojan, least of all."
He spoke. Then, mounting the beast and settling himself on its back, as so often he'd done, bronze helmet glinting and horsehair plume flaunting, he took sharp-pointed lances in either hand. Thus armed, he went into the fray at full gallop. His heart was seething with deep shame and the very ecstasy of grief, with love driven wild by loss and awareness of his own valour. Now he called out, "Aeneas!" in a loud voice, three times. Aeneas recognized that voice and prayed with a glad heart. "So may the Father of Heaven and glorious Apollo grant it. To it, then, start the fight." Without more words, spear levelled, he went to meet Mezentius, who cried,
"Do you think to frighten me, now you have taken my son, you murderer? That was the only way you could really destroy me. I'm not afraid of death, nor yet will I spare your gods. Enough! I have come to die, but first, here are some presents I've brought you."
So saying, Mezentius hurled a spear at his foe. Another then, and another, sending them in as he wheeled round Aeneas in a wide circle. But the gold-bossed shield withstood them. Three times he galloped anti-clockwise around his vigilant enemy, shooting. Three times the Trojan hero pivoted, his bronze shield bearing an ever-increasing harvest of javelins. Then, tired of these long-drawn defensive tactics and pulling out spear points, finding himself hard-pressed in such an unequal combat, Aeneas, after much thought, at last rushed forward and hurled his spear, to strike Mezentius' charger right in the forehead. The beast reared up and hung there. Its forefeet pawed at the air. Its rider was unseated. Then the horse came down on top of him, pinned him, and lay there, its shoulder put out and its head drooping. The shouts of Trojans and Latins roared like flames in the sky. Aeneas ran up, unsheathed his sword, stood over Mezentius, and said, "Where is that hothead Mezentius now, and all his brutal ferocity?" The Tuscan, recovering consciousness, gazing up at the sky, gulping the air, answered,
"Hush, foe, you need not rail, or waste words on your deadly purpose. No crime in killing? I never supposed there was when I made war. Mercy is not in the bond my Lausus made between us. I ask but one thing. If the conquered has any right to a favour, allow my body interment. I know I'm beset by my people's bitter hatred. I ask you, protect my remains from their fury, and let me rest in the same sepulchre as my son."
He spoke, and deliberately offered his throat to the sword, and received it. His life went out in waves of blood all over his armour. Book 11. Night came and went. Aurora rose up, leaving the ocean. Aeneas, although he felt a pressing duty to make time for burying his friends, and was greatly distressed by the death of Pallas, first, at daybreak, fulfilled the vows he had made for victory. Lopping the branches all round from a giant oak, he erects it upon a mound and dresses the trunk with gleaming armour he'd stripped from the enemy general, Mezentius, as a trophy to the great war god. He fastens up the blood-dabbled plumes, the broken-off spears of his foe, the breastplate which had been struck and pierced in 12 places. Upon the left side he secures the shield of bronze, and hangs from the neck the ivory scabbard. Then, for his field commanders were all mustered around him closely, he made his triumphant comrades a rousing speech.
"Gentlemen, we've performed our hardest task. For the rest, we need have no apprehension. Here are the spoils, our first fruits, from an insolent king, Mezentius. He's here in these arms, my sword won. Now we must march on Latium's capital and king. With courage, make ready to fight. Work out the war in your minds, so that there'll be no hitch, no unpreparedness, the moment the gods say, 'Lift your standards and lead the troops out of camp.' No delays, through the overcaution that comes from a faltering purpose. But first, let us commit to earth our unburied comrades, for that is the only honour the world of the dead acknowledges. Go now, and pay your last respects to those gallant hearts who shed their blood to win us this Italy for our homeland. Before anything else, convey to Evander's mourning city the body of Pallas, our brave, good comrade, whom a dark day stole from us and plunged in the bitter waters of death." Thus spoke Aeneas, weeping. Then he retired to his tent door, where old Acetes watched over the lifeless body of Pallas, which had been laid there. Acetes had served as squire to Evander in the old days in Arcadia. But then, beneath a less fortunate star, he went as an aide to his dear foster-son, Pallas. All the servants were gathered round, and a crowd of Trojans, with Trojan women whose hair streamed loose in the manner of mourning. But when Aeneas entered the lofty door, they raised to heaven a loud, long sound of keening, and beat their breasts. The royal tent was one great moan of grief and wailing. Aeneas, looking at Pallas' head on the pillow there, the snow-white face, the open wound in his young breast made by the spear of Mezentius, spoke amid rising tears.
"Poor lad! Alas, that fortune, in the hour she smiled on me, grudged me one thing, your life, and would not let you behold my kingdom, or ride back to your father's home in triumph. How different from all I promised Evander to do for you, that day I left him, when he embraced me and sent me forth to my imperial destiny. He felt some fear, and warned me how dangerous was the foe, how tough the people I'd fight with. This very moment, who knows, quite beguiled by a groundless hope, he may be paying his vows and loading the altars with offerings, while we, with mourning tributes useless to him, attend dead Pallas, who now owes nothing to any of the gods in heaven. Evander, poor man, shall see his son buried and break his heart. So much for our triumphal return that he is awaiting. So much for my solemn promise. But at least Evander will not look on a son wounded in cowardly flight, or pray for a death made accursed by the sons living on in dishonour. Alas, what a tower of strength is lost to Italy, lost to Ascanius!" When he had made lamentation, Aeneas bade them lift up the piteous corpse, and choosing 1,000 men from his whole army, detailed them to form the solemn cortege and to share in the tears of the bereaved Evander. Small consolation in such great grief, but one that was due to a sorrowing father. Others quickly construct a resilient wickerwork bier, wattling switches of oak and shoots from the arbutus tree, then shade the built-up bier with a canopy of foliage. Now they are laying young Pallas aloft on that country bed, and he resembles a flower plucked by a girl's fingers,
a gentle violet, perhaps, or a fainting hyacinth, whose sheen and shape are not yet lost, not yet departed, though Mother Earth no longer can give it sap or strength. Aeneas now brought out two purple robes that were richly brocaded in golden thread. Sidonian Dido had made them with her own hands in the old days, interweaving the fabric with threads of gold and giving all her heart to the work. In one of these robes he sadly wrapped Pallas, a farewell gesture, hooding with it the hair that would soon be burned to ashes. He made a great heap, as well, of spoil they had won in the battle against the Laurentines, and had it borne in a long procession, horses and weapons, too, they had taken from the enemy. Manacled captives there were, consigned to be gifts to the dead, victims whose blood would be sprinkled upon the altar flames. He bade the leaders themselves to carry tree trunks adorned with enemy armour, the names of the fallen foes attached to them. Forlorn Acetes, feeble and old, was supported along, beating his breast with his fists, tearing his cheeks with his nails, and often prostrating himself full length upon the ground. There were chariots in the cortege, splashed with Italian blood. Behind them paced Pallas' warhorse, Aethon, without its trappings. It wept as it walked. Yes, big tears were rolling down its muzzle. Others bore the helmet and spear of Pallas. The rest of his armour, victorious Turnus had taken. Now followed a phalanx of mourners, Trojans, all the Etruscans, Arcadians bearing their arms reversed. When the files of his comrades had gone some distance forward, Aeneas stopped, sighed heavily, then spoke. "The same dread fate of war summons me hence to weep for other dead. Brave Pallas, salute for evermore. For evermore, farewell." Aeneas said nothing further, but turned towards the ramparts and made his way into camp. Envoys had just arrived from the capital of Latium, decked in olive branches, and bringing a plea that Aeneas hand over to them their fallen, whose bodies lay everywhere on the field, and let them bury the dead in a common grave. One could have no quarrel, they said, with men defeated and lifeless. They'd once been his hosts, had promised his men their daughters, and therefore he should show mercy. Aeneas courteously granted the plea. He could not well reject it, and said these words besides. "It was indeed a malignant fate that involved you Latins in such a terrible war, and caused you to flout our friendship. You ask me to make peace with the dead, whom the fortunes of battle have killed. Believe me, I'd like to make peace with the living equally. I would not be here, but that destiny said it should be my home. It is not your people that I'm at war with, only your king, who broke off relations with me, put faith in the weapons of Turnus. Fairer if Turnus had stayed to face the death which your friends met, if he's so keen to force an issue and drive out us Trojans by fighting, he ought to have met me here in single combat. The better man, or the one heaven favoured, would have survived. Go now, and burn your unfortunate comrades upon the pyre." Aeneas had spoken. The envoys were taken aback, could find nothing to say for a while, but silently searched one another's faces. Then Drances, an old man, no friend to the young prince Turnus, who always indulged his dislike by speaking against him, began to answer Aeneas thus: "Sir Trojan, great your fame, and greater your deeds. What words can I find to extol your glory, your fairness, your feats in battle? Which is the more remarkable? Most gladly we shall report in our city what you have just said. Moreover, if circumstance makes it possible, we shall unite you with King Latinus. Let Turnus look for his own alliances. Nay, we'll delight to help you build the great walls of your destined city, and bear on our shoulders the stones for the second Troy. So Drances spoke, and his colleagues all voiced their entire agreement. A 12-day truce was arranged. Under its mediation, Trojans and Latins wandered amicably together over the wooded heights. Ash trees rang with the blows of axes, and the soaring spires of pine trees were felled. There was no end to the splitting of oak wood and fragrant cedar with wedges, the carting away of rowans in creaking wagons. And now winged rumour came, first herald of great grief, to Evander's ears, to his palace and all his city. Rumour which only just now was reporting that Pallas had beaten the Latins. Hurriedly seizing funeral torches, an antique custom, the Arcadians ran to their gates. The long, torchlight procession they formed shone like a broad parting across the fields. The Trojan cortege moved on to meet them. The mourning columns merged into one. When the mothers saw it enter the city, their shrieking ran like wildfire through the afflicted streets. No force on earth could restrain Evander now. He rushed out into the crowds, and as soon as the bier was set down, prostrated himself upon Pallas, clung to the body, weeping and moaning. For a while grief choked him. At last he just managed to find his voice.
"Oh, Pallas, this was not the promise you gave your father, that you'd be careful how you ventured into the grim fight. But I knew too well how great is the lure of glory in battle for a young man, how sweet to win fame in his first engagement. Bitter your youth's first fruits, harsh your initiation into this war so near home. Alas, that not one of the gods gave ear to my vows and prayers. My blessed wife, how lucky you were to die before such anguish could come upon you. But I have lived on, exceeding my natural term. Lived on for what? To survive my own son. Why didn't I march with our Trojan allies and fall to the enemy's fire? Would I had perished, and this cortege was carrying me, not Pallas, home. Yet, Trojans, don't think I am blaming you, or our pact, or the joining of our right hands in friendship. What has happened? Fate surely had it in store for my old age. But, though an untimely death was awaiting my son, I'll be proud that he died, leading the Teucrians into Latium, with thousands of enemy dead to his credit. Besides, I could not grace you with a worthier funeral, Pallas, than this which Aeneas the True, the mighty Trojans, the generals of the Etruscans and their whole army are giving you. They bear great trophies, symbols of those who fell by your hand. You too, Turnus, would be here. A trophy, a giant tree trunk adorned with arms. Had your age and the strength of your years been no more than my son's? But why do I let my own tragedy keep you Trojans from war? Go forth, and forget not to take back these words to your king. Tell him I linger on, though I care not for life, now Pallas is gone, to receive the debt which he knows is owing to father and son. Vengeance on Turnus! It's the sole task that remains for his courage and luck to accomplish. I ask it not to gladden my life, that were wrong, but to bring the good news to my son in the underworld.
Meanwhile, Aurora had lifted her cordial light above suffering humanity, and the daily round began again. Pyres were built up on the shore of the bay by Lord Aeneas and Tarchon now. Each, after his own traditional usage, brought hither his dead. They applied to the pyres the funereal torches, and smoke rolled up, spreading out and palling the sky above. Clad in their gleaming accoutrements, they marched three times around the blazing pyres. Three times they circled the melancholy flames of the dead, on horseback, and uttered the cries of mourning. With tears the earth was sprinkled. Their armour was wet with tears. A lamentation of men arose, and a bray of trumpets. Now some of them threw on the flames equipment which had been taken from the enemy dead, helmets, fine swords, bridles, and chariot wheels that had scorched into battle, while others were throwing the shields and unlucky weapons of their own fallen, familiar objects. They were sacrificing oxen all round to the god of death, slaughtering bristle-haired swine and sheep for which they had scoured the countryside to lay on the burning pyres. The whole length of the shore they look at their comrades burning, keep watch beside those charred pyres. Nothing can drag them away till dewy night unrolls a heaven thickly jewelled with sparkling stars. Some distance off, the dejected Italians, too, had built countless funeral pyres. Such numbers of dead there were, they buried some on the spot, lifted up others and bore them into adjacent fields, or sent them back to their city. While for the rest, a huge, indiscriminate pile of corpses, they burnt them, uncounted, anonymous. All round about, the desolate countryside was dotted with pyre after blazing pyre. When a third dawn had peeled the chill darkness off the sky, sadly they swept the ashes and bones into a heap from the smouldering pyres, and built up a barrow of still warm earth above them. But in the houses of wealthy Latinus city, the noise of mourning was loudest, greatest for long-drawn agony. Mothers, sick-hearted brides, loved sisters bewailing their brothers, children whose fathers had fallen, here in the city, were cursing the war that had brought them ruin, the betrothal of Turnus that caused it. Let him who claims for himself this realm and sovereign power here, let him, they cry, decide the issue in single combat. Drances aggravates this vindictively, making it known that Turnus, and Turnus alone is called on, is challenged to fight. All the same, there was much support for Turnus, expressed in various arguments. The queen's great name protected him. Also, his fame and the trophies he'd won told in his favour. In the middle of these cross-currents, when partisan feeling had reached high pressure, to crown it all, the envoys returned with their answer from Diomed's city, in deep depression. For all the pains they had taken, they'd got nowhere. Diomed was impervious to presents, to gold, to urgent entreaties. He said the Latins must look for allies elsewhere, or come to terms with Aeneas. Latinus himself collapsed under his load of anguish. The wrath of the gods, the new graves in front of his eyes, told him heaven's will was beyond dispute, and Aeneas had fate behind him. Therefore, Latinus convened a privy council, commanding the foremost of his people to appear in his lofty palace. They came together, their numbers crowding the streets as they flocked to the royal home. Latinus, the eldest and wielding supreme authority, sat in their midst, a gloomy look on his face. And now he bade the envoys, returned from the Aetolian city, to make their report, and to set out in full detail what Diomed had replied. Absolute silence followed, as Venulus, obeying the king, began to speak. "Citizens, we accomplished our journey, surmounting all its hazards. We saw Diomed in his Argive settlement, and pressed the hand which wiped out the country of Ilium. He was building a city, Arpi, named after his father's people, on land he had won in war round about Apulian Garganus. Entering his palace, we sought and were given a personal interview. So we presented our gifts to him, told him our names and nation, what had brought us to Arpi, and who had invaded our country. Diomed heard us out, then replied, with an equable mien, "You people of ancient Italy, from the kingdom of old Saturn, so blessed by fortune, what ill wind is troubling your calm regime, and driving you to provoke war, who have no experience in warfare? All we who profaned with the sword the land of Ilium, I leave aside what we went through during the battles beneath Troy's walls, and our heroic dead engulfed in the Simois. All of us suffered condign and terrible retribution, wherever we went, so that even Priam must pity us. Look at the storm that wrathful Athene raised, wrecking Ajax on Cape Caphyrius in Euboea. After that war, driven to wide-apart coasts, Menelaus, the son of Atreus, was exiled far away at the pillars of Proteus. Ulysses beheld the Cyclops of Aetna. Neoptolemus' kingdom partitioned, Idomeneus' home broken up. Why talk of them? Or the Locrians compelled to settle in Africa? Agamemnon himself, the leader of our Greek expedition, fell at the hands of his damnable wife in the first hour of his homecoming, for an adulterer lurked behind conquered Asia. Look how the gods have grudged me a sight of the wife I long for, and beautiful Calydon, stopped me returning to my home altars. Even now I'm pursued by things of ill omen, dreadful to look at. My own lost comrades changed into birds, made off to the sky. An uncanny retribution they suffer, haunting the streams, and the cliffs are loud with their melancholy cries. What else could I expect but horrors such as these from the moment I raised my sword to the person of a divinity, wounding the hand of Venus, committing a sacrilege on her? No, no, don't push me into another war like that. No quarrel have I with the Teucrians since Troy's annihilation, nor does it give me pleasure to recall those bad old days. As for the presents you've brought me out of your native land, give them instead to Aeneas. We've faced his tigerish weapons, have met him hand to hand. Believe me, I know from experience how he springs at you with his shield up, how his spear comes at you like a hurricane. If two other champions of equal caliber had risen in Troyland, the Dardans would have stormed up to the cities of Greece. Aye! Fate had changed sides, and its Greece would be mourning today. That we stayed so long, investing the walls of stubborn Troy, that victory kept on eluding the Greeks and came not until the 10th year, was due to the efforts of Hector and Aeneas. Both were outstanding in courage and feats of arms, but the latter stood first in devotion of heart. I advise you, make terms with him as best you may. Don't risk fighting it out on the battlefield. Good king, you have heard the reply King Diomed sent, and with it the views he expressed about this great war that we are engaged in. The envoys had barely finished when a mutter of conflicting comment arose among the uneasy Italians. So, when a torrent is checked by boulders, it frets against them and babbles, and the banks on either side resound with chattering water. As soon as they had calmed down, and their anxious murmurs were silenced, the king, first invoking heaven, spoke from his lofty throne. I could wish, and it would have been better, gentlemen, that we had reached some decision ere now on so crucial a matter.
not had to call a meeting at a time like this, when the enemy's at our gates. We are waging an ill-advised war, fellow citizens, with a people of heavenly descent, unconquerable. No amount of fighting wears them down. Though beaten, they never relinquish the sword. If you had any hopes of an armed alliance with the Aetolians, resign them. Our only hope is in ourselves, and you see how slim it is. That, apart from Diomed's refusal, our fortunes are a total wreck, is plain and palpable. I am not blaming anyone. Whatever a people's valor could do was done. Our realm put all it had into the struggle. Give me your close attention while I explain briefly what seems to me, though I'm not sure, best to do in our present dilemma. I possess land along the Tiber. It's been crown property from ancient times, stretching westwards far, right up to and over the Sicilians' frontier. Oruncans and Rutuli farm it, working the stony hills with the plough and grazing their roughest slopes. Let us cede the whole of this area, with its pine-covered mountain ridge, to gain the goodwill of the Trojans. Let us draw up a treaty, fair to both sides, and invite them to partner us in the kingdom. If they want it so much, let them found a city and settle down here. But if they intend to possess themselves of the land of some other nation, and are at liberty to leave this soil of ours, let us build them 20 ships of Italian oak, or more, if they can man them. All the raw material lies at the water's edge. They can say what class of ships and how many they want. We will supply the bronze, the labor, the shipyards. Further, to take our proposals and ratify the agreement, I would send 100 envoys, men of our most distinguished families. They should offer the olive branch to Aeneas, bearing as presents gold and ivory, a talent of each, with the chair and purple robe, the insignia of my kingship. Now, express your own views. Our affairs are desperate. You must mend them. Then Drances, hostile as ever to Turnus, whose high renown pinpricked him with sour envy to intrigue against him, a man influential through his wealth, an able speaker, but no lion at fighting, one whose advice in debate was accounted weighty, a force in political faction. His well-born mother gave him great pride of race. There was nothing to say of his father. Drances got up and stoked the high feeling there with a speech. Your gracious majesty, the issue you ask our advice on is crystal clear and does not require our comments. Everyone admittedly knows what this crisis demands, but they shrink from expressing it. Let him but allow us to speak, and refrain from his usual blustering. Him whose unlucky star and perverseness of mind have caused— No, I will speak, though he mortally menaces me with his violence— have caused the death of so many of our brightest captains, and drowned the whole city in mourning, while he, confident of his own getaway, attacked the Trojan encampment, and scared with his weapons the blue sky. You should add one more to those many presents you bid us take and promise to the Dardan people, just one thing more, most gracious of kings, and let not anyone's intransigence have the power to prevent you giving your daughter in honourable marriage to an excellent man, thus cementing a peace between us for ever. But if our hearts and minds are obsessed by terror of Turnus, let us implore and beseech him in his infinite grace to stand down and restore to his king and country the marriage rights he lays claim to. O, head and source of these disasters to Latium, why are you always thrusting her luckless folk into obvious peril? Fighting will not save us. It's peace that we all demand of you, Turnus, and with it the one pledge of peace that cannot be broken. I, whom you claim to be hostile to you, well, what if I am? I take the lead in imploring you. Look at me.
pity your people. Strip off your pride. Admit yourself beaten and go. We have seen enough deaths in this rout, have unpopulated our countryside, but if you lust for glory, if you're so hardy of heart, and if you're so set upon a royal bride, a king's palace, be bold. Trust in your own strength.